welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Henrik from Sweden, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. If you remember, you can also watch the video of this interview on redicemembers.com. We are going to start to do selective programs as video from now on here and there, so definitely watch out for that in the future. By the way, the new website, redice.tv, is finally up and running. We are delighted and very happy about that. So please go explore, enjoy. It is much more mobile-friendly and just looks so much better. One thing I want to alert you about is the RSS feeds. They will work as usual. The feed is just redirecting to the new feed on the new site. However, we welcome that you go to redice.tv/RSS and subscribe to the new feeds with iTunes, Downcast, BeyondPod, or whatever app you're using on your computer, tablet, or phone. Our guest today is Jared Taylor, who joins us via webcam. So again, if you want to watch this interview, please go to redicemembers.com. Coming into the subscription zone, you are more than welcome. We'll be doing live streams for members about once a week, starting probably at the end of May, after we've reorganized a few things here in the studio with our setup after our marathon and fundraiser live broadcast that we did here last week. Again, I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who donated to us. You can still do so. We have added an edited version of the live show on redice.tv now. We'll be adding it for members soon here as well. And also, we are going to, of course, update the members' website as soon as we can sign off on the new site 100% and squash any bugs. Now, let's switch over to our guest here today. You know Jared Taylor, founder of American Renaissance. Amarin.com is the website. We have the upcoming conference, Trump, and the updated Color of Crime report, and much more to discuss. Welcome back, Jared Taylor. Thank you so much for coming on with us, and it's a pleasure to see you this time as well. Good to have you with us.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We have a lot to discuss today. I definitely want to plug the upcoming Amarin conference here. 2016, you guys had a great conference last year, and it's always a lot of fun to help get the word out about some of the events and meetups and whatnot. But I wanted to ask you a bit about the recent debate that you took part in here recently as well. Tell us how this came together and what happened during the debate.
Well, it was quite interesting. I was approached by a black president who is working at a historically black university named Will Riley. And it was his idea that we have a debate on the subject of whether racial diversity is a strength for America. And obviously, I think I had the better half of the debate in saying that it was an obvious weakness. And I made what I think are a bunch of really quite devastating arguments. And what surprised me most in his reply was that his idea of one of the great advantages of diversity for America is racial mixing. And he said, in 200 years, I don't expect there to be any more white people in America, and that's a good thing. So for him, one of the great advantages of diversity is the ultimate extinction of my people. And they call me a hate monger.
Extraordinary. And, of course, yeah. He could do these comments without any kind of protest from the audience, right?
Oh, of course not. Of course not. There'll be no professional repercussions for him. If I had talked about some sort of scheme to eliminate black people from the United States, oh, my gosh, I'd never live that down.
That's true.
But a fellow who's celebrating the prospective extinction of white people. No, that goes without raising anyone's eyebrows.
Remind us again when this was and where it took place, Jared.
This was the early part of May, and as I say, it is Kentucky State University. That is in Frankfort, Kentucky, which is the state capital. But no, I was flown down and put up in a hotel, and they have promised to pay me an honorarium. The honorarium has yet to appear. I'm counting on it showing up. But no, it was really quite an interesting event. The audience was mostly blacks, but a few whites. This is one of these historically black universities that has about 40% whites in its student body. Increasingly, they're trying to get more people, more funding, etc., and the whites were all great fans of diversity. But to me, it was typical of a black audience in that when we started talking about Michael Brown, they were saying, oh, he was shot. He was surrendering with his hands up. You know, the usual hands up, don't shoot nonsense. And I started to say, well, no, he was high on marijuana. He had just robbed a convenience store. And then I was interrupted by just a mass of shouting. They refused to hear the facts about Michael Brown. Just would not. It's as if they had put their fingers in their ears. Don't tell us the truth about Michael Brown.
Yeah.
That's the mentality we're dealing with.
Can't touch one of their saints, you know.
No.
That's what happens. No. I guess it's religious in nature, right?
Yeah, well, and the sad thing is that they have to choose such thugs and losers like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown. These are their new saints. My God, it's really a very, very sad commentary on the state of Black America that people such as these are now their martyrs and heroes. My gosh.
You've done quite a bit of these speeches. You've been traveling around quite a bit. You've been on TV shows, etc. You're pretty well known, I guess, in people who are very adamant about discussing race in America and racial relations, etc. I mean, is it usually pretty okay for you in terms of security, or do you have to have security with you when you go to some of these events, or what's it like?
They did have a number of armed policemen patrolling the halls, and I was escorted back to my car by a policeman. But so far, no one has ever tried to take a poke at me. We get death threats from time to time here in the office. And at the time of the shootings in Charleston, when Dylann Roof killed those 9 Black people, we had quite a flurry of death threats. But these have all just been empty threats. No one has ever tried to confront me physically. I suppose I should knock on wood, but I think most people realize that breaking the law in some violent way could really backfire on them. If somebody wants to find me and shoot me, I'm very, very easy to find. I just can't spend my life worrying about that.
Well, watch out, because it's heating up in America as ever before, you know, specifically with Trump now coming in as well.
Yes, things are certainly heating up. You said that, yes, lately I have gotten a flurry of media interest, but almost all of it is thanks to Trump. And, of course, the way they use people like me, the mainstream media, is to hang a loathsome person such as myself around Trump's neck and say, look at this horrible man who supports Trump. Trump, too, is obviously a horrible man. And so for that reason, I've gotten more attention since Trump became prominent than I've had in some time. As a matter of fact, at the time of the late 90s, really sort of barely into the early 2000s, it was very easy for me to get on television or radio programs. But then, with the arrival of the Internet, things really began to clamp down. And I think that it has to do with the fact that just as soon as someone Googles me, they discover that the Southern Poverty Law Center says, oh, no, this guy is someone we have called a hate monger. And that intimidates a lot of people. In fact, we used to publicize all of my radio talks, for example, speaking engagements ahead of time on our website. And then we discovered that increasingly, the SPLC would call up ahead of time and say, no, you want to disinvite this guy. He may sound reasonable, but he's going to be tricking your listeners. He's going to be tricking your audience. He's a hate monger. You just can't tell right away. And people would disinvite me, or I remember being told by one television producer that they'd gotten a call from the SPLC saying, no, you shouldn't have this guy on, and they decided not to have me on. So I publicize it less, and I get fewer invitations. But as I say, it's thanks to Trump, and it's an attempt to discredit Trump through people like me that I've had really more media appearances than any time in the last 6 or 7 years, I would say.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely talk more about Trump later, but let me ask you about, you know, this aspect that you mentioned, that if they didn't declare your reprehensible views before you did some of these, you know, talks or whatever, do you think that more and more people would agree with you, but like before they actually have been told by one of the experts or whatever, whether it's media or maybe at one of these universities, that your opinions are you can't listen to this man because he's morally reprehensible, basically?
Yes, that's exactly the tactic. The theory is this guy is an unhinged hater, and therefore anything he says can be dismissed out of hand. That's the approach of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Their plan is not to try to debate you or refute you. It is simply to discredit you by calling you names and, even better, shut you up completely. Now, as far as the way audiences react now, it'll often be the case that even on a conservative host will be surprised when callers will call in and say, I agree with every single thing Mr. Taylor says. I think that there is a definite sea change in the way Americans are prepared to talk about race, especially if they have the anonymity of a call-in program or if they're contributing to the comments page of a newspaper website, for example. It is still dangerous to come out publicly, as I have, and say entirely sensible things about race. You can lose your job. If you're a young faculty member looking for tenure, that's not a good step to take. But the number of people out there who agree with us is growing all the time. I've never been more optimistic about the prospects for sensible opinions and even sensible policies about race.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, definitely. I think it has a lot to do with Trump. Now, before we go there, talk about what's happening now, I think when the Dylann Roof shooting occurred in Charleston, I think you kind of jumped into a role of being a spokesperson for the Council of Conservative Citizens, I believe. Now, was that a last-minute thing, or do you have that kind of relationship with them?
No, it was a last-minute thing. They had preferred not to react to media inquiries at all, and I thought that was a big mistake. I thought it was very important that someone step forward and say what the Council of Conservative Citizens were presenting on its webpage was factual information. It was factual information that Dylann Roof had never been able to find anywhere else. The mainstream media had certainly never explained to him the extent of black-on-white crime and had played up all of these allegations about white-on-black crime. For him, what astonished him was to discover what really happened in the Trayvon Martin business. That's when he started poking around the Internet. He stumbled onto the CFCC website, and he discovered that there's an enormous amount of black-on-white crime that is totally ignored by the media. And that's what sent him along this path of discovery that led to this really quite horrible denouement. But it was very important, I thought, that someone speak for the Council of Conservative Citizens, explain the kind of information they had, and why it could be so shocking to a young, naive white guy to discover the truth about interracial crime.
Right. I mean, was there any, I don't know if it, I didn't watch all of your, the interviews that you did, but I did watch a few of them. How was the relationship there? I mean, were you able to actually address the media sensibly, or were they just looking for someone to scapegoat, basically? And you, for that time, became kind of the face of that, right?
To some degree, it is possible to state a few facts. The one fact that I tried to get across in every interview, if I could, was that of the approximately 600,000 acts of interracial violence involving blacks and whites, blacks are the aggressors 85% of the time. This is something that is well-established statistically. The Bureau of Justice Statistics has all of these numbers, but nobody ever talks about them. And occasionally I was able to get that fact into an interview. But most of the time, it is an opportunity simply to call you names and say that you're a white supremacist, et cetera, et cetera. Even so, I thought that it was far more important to have someone speak for a particular point of view rather than simply run away and clam up. I think when they say they were not available, they wouldn't return our calls, or they were afraid to come on television, I think that makes a very, very bad impression.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I liked the way that the media consequently blamed basically all white people. There was a number of headlines that were rolled out like this after Dylann Roof and the shooting. But despite that, I think it went away pretty quick, though. I thought that this would linger for months and months, but I guess that's just kind of it went into the memory hole to a certain extent. The media has a short-term memory, and they move along to the next thing in within a few months or something, right?
Yes, although it seemed to me they played it up for a mighty long time. Remember, there was the President of the United States went to Charleston and gave that talk. We heard about it for a very long time. And furthermore, remember, there was the battle against the Confederate flag that went on for months.
Yes.
Confederate
yes.
flags had to be taken down all around the South. Confederate monuments and memorials became targets of the social justice warriors. So they milked it, I thought, for about all that it was worth. Now, the other thing that's going to happen, Dylann Roof is still with us. Dylann Roof, at some point, is going to go on trial. That will be yet again an extraordinary circus. And it will be very interesting to me whether the media then comes back to someone like me, depending on the sorts of things Dylann Roof says publicly in court. If Dylann Roof talks about interracial crime, if Dylann Roof talks about the horrible effects that affirmative action has, racial preferences have, on young white men like him, if he talks about all of this fanatical boosting of pride for every group but his, Southern men are the one people who must not have any pride in their heritage. If he starts making points like that, it could be an extraordinary thing, even though he is a mass murderer. So when he goes to trial, then there will be an enormous circus of some kind from which perhaps, just perhaps, a certain amount of good could come. But in the backdrop of all of this is mass murderer Dylann Roof, racist, Confederate sympathizer. That is what we will hear over and over and over again. But I think and I hope that it may be possible to insert some explanation as to what motivated him into the circus that will surround his trial. We'll see what can be done.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. I actually forgot about the flag debacle and the attack of the statues. You're right. I mean, this framed the whole dialogue, really, in the way that they managed to attack Southern heritage. Robert E. Lee, I know there's even a mundane thing such as a burger being renamed from like Robert E. Lee or something to, I forget what they named it to, but it was in Charleston. I read about that.
Of course, what was so blatantly hypocritical about the whole thing was that whenever some fanatical Muslim shoots up a bunch of Christians or white people, always the immediate reaction is, no, 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 we must not blame Muslims in general. Islam is a religion of peace. This man was just one crazy fanatic lunatic. Never the case for white people.
No.
Here's a guy who waves the Confederate flag. Well, that means all Confederate flags are evil. All Southern white people are potential mass murderers. Just the blatant, breathtaking hypocrisy of it should have ashamed them. But they have, obviously, no shame.
Why is it, do you think, that he didn't decide to speak with the media, or is it just simply the police and where he's being held that didn't allow this to happen?
You know, that's a good question. In fact, I've thought about trying to approach the people who hold him and see if I could interview him.
That's right. We have the same. Yeah, the same.
Yes, we've had. Have you attempted to do that, though?
No, not yet. No. I forget exactly where he was held now, but it's actually the cell next to the police officer that actually shot a black man in Charleston as well. I forget. Maybe you recall his name.
Yes, I remember that incident. I don't remember. Is that the fellow who shot the guy in the back?
I believe so. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
They're cellmates, door neighbors, basically.
Yes. Yeah. For heaven's sake, they're cellmates. Well, no, I would love to be able to interview Dylann Roof. I've made no attempt to do so.
Yeah.
I think about it and then I don't get around to it. I don't know what the procedure is, but there will be an awful lot about Dylann Roof. He will rise from the media silence in the most thunderous way when he is put on trial.
Yeah. Do you know when that is? I think they've postponed it a couple of times, if I'm correct.
Yes. I don't know when it's exactly scheduled for. I wish I did, but I can't give you an answer on that.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Very, very interesting. Now, let's talk a bit about some of the other things that you have upcoming. I do want to spend some time talking about the conference. We did so last year when you were with us as well. This is mostly, I think, an annual thing. I think there's a few years maybe you haven't done it annually, if I'm correct. But tell us a bit about the conference and what it's about.
Well, the history of the conference goes back to 1994. That's when we had our first one. It's hard to believe that I've been doing this for what, 22 years now? Gracious. And we had them every other year at first. Then our conference was canceled for 2 years in a row because the hotels with which we had contracted to hold the conference came in for such intimidation and such pressure from so-called anti-racists that they decided they were better off not having the conference, even if it meant walking away from several hundred thousand dollars worth of business, and even if they had to write us a cancellation check in five figures. 1 year, four hotels in a row canceled on us. We would get a check. We would go to another hotel. They'd cancel. We'd get another check. I mean, we joked about how you could go into business doing this. But, of course, we wanted a conference, not cancellation checks, for heaven's sake.
Right.
Well, when a hotel gets a telephoned message saying, if you hold this conference, we will go in there and shoot people, mean, that really doesn't give them much choice.
Was that what happened?
That happened on one occasion. One hotel reported that to us. Now, if they get a call like that and something really does happen, imagine the kind of lawsuits they would face.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, that is just empty threat. Nobody's going to walk into one of our conferences and start shooting people. But if someone has made that threat and then something dangerous actually happens, then it seems to me a defendant in a lawsuit, the hotel, is really going to be in a difficult situation. So for 2 years in a row, we canceled. These were really, to me, in some respects, the most awful experiences in my life. Here you have 250 people who have bought airplane tickets. They're expecting to come for a weekend of great fellowship, and then I have to let them know, no, we're not holding it. We've been driven off the premises. And in fact, a lot of our cancellation fees were spent sending $200 checks to the people who had made these non-refundable airplane tickets.
Yeah.
I thought the least we could do was, after all, you can usually use the bulk of your fare for another trip, but you lose $200. So we wrote lots of checks for $200. Sorry to see that money go, but that seemed to be the only honest thing to do under the circumstances.
Yeah.
But for the last, 4 or 5 years, we've held our conferences in a state park in Tennessee. This is a state-owned facility. And so if you call up the state of Tennessee and say, we will shoot you if you hold that conference, their reaction is, hey, just try. They have got park police there, well-armed, very burly, very serious-looking white men out there who will take no nonsense from anyone. So we've been having our conferences, and at the same time we get entertained by this band of spectacular scruffies who chant all sorts of crazy crazy slogans at us. I remember once was more Dresdens. They want more Dresdens. And They would hold up a picture of an AK-47, and they'd say, this is for killing racists. Oh, it's like a ticket to the circus or a ticket to the zoo to see these creatures out there. So usually about cocktail hour on Saturday, we can count on this diverting floor show of scruffies and unattractive girls, fat people. It's an extra part of the ticket that we don't have to pay for. But in terms of the security of the locale, we are absolutely squared away. No difficulties whatsoever, and it's certainly a relief not to have to worry about it. But we are outgrowing the premises. The conference center has only 120 hotel rooms, which we book every single one of them every year. We're spilling out into the hotels and motels roundabout, and at some point we may even have a difficulty running up against the fire code in terms of the number of people we can fit in the auditorium. So certainly this year it's going to be a record-breaking attendance for what is sure to be a very, very memorable and uplifting occasion, especially, as you say, with the spirit of Trump hovering over the proceedings.
Yeah, I guess that's a good problem to have to run out of space.
Yes.
Is there anything nearby in case you get to that point where people can stay and so forth? I heard it was quite a ways away, right?
Well, that's the trouble. You see, it's about a 45-minute drive from Nashville Airport. We used to hold our conferences at airport hotels. So you could fly in, if you wanted to drive in, you could drive, there was plenty of free parking. If you wanted to fly in, then you just take the airport shuttle. It makes it much more complicated to get to the conference. It's a terrible thing. But I like to have the conferences in a place where people can both meet and spend the night in the same establishment. It makes for a kind of community. And since we have rented the entire place, we have our own little Alania for the weekend. We are the only people there. It's really quite a thrilling time, but in terms of logistics, it is complicated. I suspect that if we held our meetings as we used to in first-class hotels that are near an international airport, we'd have another 150, 200 people in attendance.
Right, right. Well, good news. It's really good. Tell us about the lineup this year and some of the speakers.
Well, Peter Brimelow, I'm sure you're aware of who he is.
Sure, certainly.
The impresario of VDARE. James Edwards, I'm sure you know, the political cesspool. We also are going to have a number of people who are less well known. For example, a fellow named Fernando Cortez. He'll be our first Mexican speaker, but he is very much an identitarian. and he will approach the question of illegal immigration from a Mexican nationalist, but also identitarian point of view. I've spoken on the phone about on this question about him. He has a very interesting perspective on it. I think he will give an extremely interesting talk. We also have a fellow that we've never had before named Ruben Kellop, and he is an Estonian who is one of the founding members of the Conservative People's Party, which is an openly nationalist party. And he is going to be talk about the title of his talk is A Call to Action from a Small White Country. It's small, and they want to keep it white. It's a very exciting prospect. Sometimes I think that the Eastern Europeans, well, frequently I think the Eastern Europeans, have a very exciting destiny before them because they can openly take the view that they wish to preserve their nation, their peoplehood, and they have political parties that represent them. This is a very, very exciting thing that we certainly don't have yet in the United States. But another one of our speakers is always a perennial favorite, Ramsey Paul. I don't know if you've ever interviewed him on your show.
Certainly have. Yes, yeah, of course.
He's one of these geniuses who can talk about serious things in a funny way. I wish I had that talent. When I start talking about race and the survival of our people and the destiny of Western civilization, I get grimly serious. I can't crack a joke. So I love people who have this light touch and who can talk about these deadly serious things, but in a way that draws in people in a humorous way. I think he's one of those geniuses. Then Dan Root is a fellow who's spoken at the previous American Renaissance Conference. He's a South African. A very, very well-educated, thoughtful, excellent speaker. He has written for a number of articles for us, but he always has the European perspective from the southern tip of Africa. Really a most remarkable guy. And then, of course, the immortal Sam Dixon. I don't know if he's ever been a guest on your program.
Sure, yep, same there.
Really a brilliant, brilliant man. And then we have two people from the Vlaams Belang. Those are the people who are fighting for an independent Flanders, but an independent Flemish, European, white Flanders. One is Philip de Winter, and the other is Anke van der Meersch. Anke van der Meersch, in fact, will be our first lady speaker.
Is that the first, really?
Yes, wow. The very first. And she will turn heads for other reasons as well. She's 6 feet 2 inches tall and a former Miss Holland.
Nice.
Yes. Wow. Yes. So we're particularly pleased to have her. So also we are going to have a debut video produced by Uncuck the Right. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, for sure. Are they going to be there? Right? Or. Well, maybe it's just one guy. I'm not sure.
It's mostly one guy, and he had every intention of being there, but there were some travel snags that came up, and so I'm very sorry he will not be there.
Oh, too bad. Yeah.
But we're going to debut a video that is made just for the conference, and I suppose I'm giving nothing away when I say that I am in this video, and believe it or not, I both sing and play the saxophone.
Really now?
Yes.
So it's great. So a real collaboration between Uncuck the Right and Jared Taylor here then, huh?
That's right.
Awesome.
That's right. I think it is great to have people like that who are approaching these questions from a completely different point of view. I take this sort of ploddingly logical approach to explain why, yes, white people have the right to their own institutions, and there are these double standards. Yes, there are IQ studies that explain to us why things are so grim and glum in Africa. And then you have these young guys who put together these brilliant satirical musicals. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, it is. We definitely need more like that, which it's off the cuff. It's easily digestible. And you're right. I mean, it doesn't take it into that serious area, but it's built on work that you have done, right? So that we need a foundation of these statistics. We need a foundation that it actually is the truth. It's relevant. It means something. But the delivery is something that many have struggled with for years, to be honest.
Yes, exactly. Getting this message across. The truth is on our side. Science is on our side. History, human nature, morality, they're all on our side.
Yeah.
It's just a question of getting this message across in an attractive way. Just the other day, I discovered this little posting on the internet by some young fellow who says, I have to have a lot of respect for Jared Taylor. He's been standing up for white people since before it was even cool. Well,
yeah.
I'm very pleased if it is now cool.
It is.
I'd like to think that I had a small hand in making it cool, but the fact is, it's people like Ramsey Paul and Uncut the Right who have really made it cool. Maybe I have sort of blown apart a little bit of the resistance to it, but I can't claim to be the guy who has made it cool. But if it's cool, that's wonderful.
Well, that's true. It's really good. So overall, though, I mean, how long have you been involved in this now, Jared? How many years?
Oh, boy, 25 years now.
Right.
25 years. American Renaissance started as a paper publication. And we went full internet about 3 years ago, and we're able to reach far, far more people. And as I say, when I first started doing this, all I would have to do is send a few issues to radio stations or television stations, and I would get at least a dozen, maybe a score of invitations to talk about these things. But then it's a period that Peter Brimwell calls the interglacial period. You know, there's this in geology, the glaciers came down, they went back, and then they came down again. There was this brief window in the 1990s when the bell curve came out. My book about race was picked up by a mainstream publishing house. Michael Levin was writing about race. Peter Brimelow was writing about race. There seemed to be this sort of window. And then the Iron Curtain just slammed down. And it became much more difficult to get a mainstream audience for these very sensible and important ideas. But it's coming back. It's coming back thanks to Donald Trump.
Yeah, indeed. Before we shift over to Trump and talk about some of the things, I know that you guys have an updated version of The Color of Crime as well that we need to talk about a bit later, but tell us just where people can get tickets. Are you guys selling out? Should people hurry? What's going on with that?
We are just about to sell out. And so if people wish to come to the conference, and I think it's going to be the best yet, they can come to our webpage at amren.com, and we have an advertisement for it right on the homepage. At this point, as I say, unfortunately, you can no longer stay in the conference site at Montgomery Bell State Park, which is a beautiful place, but they have very reasonably priced hotels and motels in the town of Dixon, which is about a 10-minute drive away. So people will have to drive in for the events, but they can, of course, after hours and during the breaks, they can certainly take part in the fellowship and the community building and the network that always goes on at our conferences. So we still have a few more places available. There are also a few more places available at the banquet. But for the banquet, too, we're running up against the limits of the space. As you say, it's a good problem to have, but I wish there was something equivalent to this that were much larger that we could move to. But a state-owned facility of this kind, where you can have a meeting and people can have sleeping rooms and spend the night, and in this case, you've got hiking trails and a beautiful lake to row on, but nobody does that. People just hang around and talk. Yep. It's a wonderful place, just too small.
Well, there you go. Well, we'll definitely try to make it this year, see if we can get some tickets in time here. We'll definitely want to come, and there's some great people there, and you'll be doing a talk as well, right?
Oh, I will be giving a talk. I suppose I should have mentioned that. Yes, I've given a talk at every single one. It's always a bit of a struggle to come up with something I haven't said before. But
well, when you're going to arrange it all and pull it all together, then by the time you're there to do the talk, your head is usually not there. I know how that goes, setting things up for a show and stuff like that. But you always do a good job, Jared. So you know, I'm sure you'll do great this year as well.
Thank you, Vinod. It'll be a great conference, a wonderful conference.
Very good. Excellent. Well, let's kind of switch gears here a bit then and talk about Trump. I mean, he secured the nomination here, what was it now, a few days ago by the time we're doing this recording. And the same day we had Kasich drop out. Also, of course, Cruz dropped out. And the media just couldn't believe that all this was happening. They had been attacking him like I think no other presidential candidate possibly in history. I'm not too familiar with all of it, but it has been an incredible onslaught on Trump, and despite this, he has persevered, and he now has the Republican nomination. What's your thoughts on all this?
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled by this, I must say. There are certain aspects of Trump's personality and his style that I wouldn't find particularly attractive. But he is the first candidate, probably in 50 years perhaps, who has an unblinkingly America-first view of immigration, for example. He's the first candidate, certainly in my lifetime, that has come out and said, look, immigration has got to be in our interest. And he has taken a critical look at who's coming across the border. And some of them are rapists. Some of them are murderers. That's obviously true. But we live in such a tongue-tied, gagged society to point out the obvious scandalizes people. Also, this idea of really getting serious about keeping illegal immigrants out. That's another breakthrough. And then, of course, this idea that he has that perhaps we don't need any more Muslims. Now, whenever I'm asked about Trump and why I support Trump, I ask what is not a rhetorical question. I ask them, what have Muslims brought for America that we should be proud of, or that we should want more of? Look at what we're doing to Europe. Why do we want this on ourselves? And, of course, they can't answer. There's no answer to that question. But to have a major presidential candidate raising these questions is absolutely without precedent. I don't know, I feel quite sure that Donald Trump is not a thoroughgoing, thoughtful race realist or white advocate the way you or me or some of our other colleagues are. He doesn't think in those terms, but he has good instincts. He is the kind of fellow who, it seems to me, I could imagine actually coming out and saying, well, what's wrong with white people wanting to live in a majority white country? I can imagine him saying that. Whereas, and he may never say that, but I am absolutely positive that not anybody else on any ticket is ever going to even come close to saying that, would never even think it. Or Donald Trump could even conceivably say, well, is it possible that blacks aren't doing so well because they have an average IQ of 85? I mean, maybe he will never say such a thing, but he is a man for whom such an observation is not absolutely inconceivable. He said things that are in their own way just as shocking. Let's hope that he moves in that direction. And I'm sure that his campaign and his appointments will attract people who, in fact, do think in those terms. They will be there. They will be there in the wings. They will be as part of his staff because more and more people see things the way we see them, and as he draws on support and staff, these people will filter into positions of influence and perhaps even some sort of power. If he becomes president, this could be a real change in the way all of these questions are approached.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Van Joneses and some of these other pundits on CNN and other mainstream media outlets have, of course, already slapped the white supremacy label on him.
But the
question is how much he is, as you say, aware of the ongoing displacement of European Americans. He's commented on Merkel. I mean, he has German heritage, I believe. He visited a while back. I saw a video, quite interesting. He visited some small German town where apparently his family was from, or his father or something. And he's commented he doesn't like what Merkel is doing. He understands these things. And many people have been kind of trying to, you know, read between the lines of what he's saying, and like he must be aware of these kinds of things. But what do you think on this? Is he aware, but he's maybe at this stage smart enough just not to kind of talk openly about it? What do you think?
I believe he has said that Muslims are destroying Europe. I think he's used those very words. Now, to what extent he has thought carefully and systematically about these things, I don't know. Again, he's a man who has sound, healthy instincts. To what extent he then acts on these instincts, to what extent he's able to ignore the absolute shrieking that would follow some kind of statement about the necessity of whites preserving their civilization, their culture, I don't know. All I can tell you is that there are possibilities for him that are absolutely unthinkable in any other candidate. And even if he never raises these questions explicitly, as you say, everybody already accuses him of being a hater and a white supremacist and a racist and all of these things. All of this is making the sting of those names of hater, white supremacist, less powerful. if the president of the United States is called a white supremacist, for heaven's sake, who's going to be afraid of being called a white supremacist anymore? I think even if he does nothing but, in fact, get rid of the illegal immigrants, as he's promised to do, and keep any more illegal immigrants from coming out, his mere presence in a position of power, his mere presence as the Republican nominee, opens up a whole terrain of discussion, of possibility, of unthinkable thoughts that would have been utterly inconceivable without Trump.
Yeah, the one thing that people seem to be almost the most excited about on his rallies, I've been watching quite a few of them. Right Side Broadcasting has done many of them online. So you can actually catch them on YouTube. I think at least the primary rallies, of course, that's over now, that phase of it. But one of the things that people seem most excited about is when the wall comes up. They're all shouting for the wall. You know, it's incredible to see that. What do you think? I mean, we have that issue, of course. That's huge in itself. But what else about his policies or politics or opinions is it that is attractive to many Americans?
I think that is, frankly, the most important thing. The fact that he wants to keep illegals out, that he is prepared to break taboos in talking about immigrants, the fact that he doesn't want any Muslims. What is it, 70% of Republican voters agree with him on Muslims? And I think it's something like 35 or 40% of Democrats agree with him on Muslims. Here is a guy who is saying things that millions of Americans think and believe, and he is too important to be shut up. I think that's hugely important. At the same time, I think there is a certain segment of the voting population that really is sick and tired of the United States decline. They do want protectionism. They do want Americans to have industrial jobs back again. I tend to be something of a free trader, but I understand the impulse to protect American jobs, and I think it's extremely important. We have this rootless band of capitalists who are prepared to export jobs if that means they can improve their dividend by one penny a quarter. We have people who have no loyalty whatsoever to the United States who are running our economy. They may think twice about doing the sorts of things they've been doing so far. And at the same time, Americans, I think ordinary Americans, do not detest government the way conservatives wish they would. What they detest about government is when it stands up for illegal immigrants, when it stands up and helps non-whites, when it insists on treating sexual freaks as if they were not sexual freaks, when it gives money to people who are obvious layabouts. That's what Americans don't like. But they're perfectly happy to have Social Security, for example, whereas Jeb Bush and all of these other sort of hard, the typical beltway conservatives who talk about small government and privatizing all of this stuff, that doesn't work. That doesn't work for most Americans. So it's a combination of, at the same time, an almost leftist domestic policy, but at the same time, a nationalist sense of immigration. So it's really the first time that a major politician in the United States has combined the appeal of someone like Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen. On the one hand, they are appealing to people who want to be looked after by government in a legitimate way, their retirement, for example, mm-hmm. or their medical help after they've gotten older. These are programs that they've paid into. Most Americans think that is a legitimate function of government. So that is an appeal to the left, in a way, at least from an American point of view. And at the same time, they're appealing to nationalism. So this sense of nation and also this sense of government helping people who have worked hard. Trump is the very first person to combine those two appeals. And he's done it, I think, without much calculation. He's just done it in an instinctual way. And it's worked brilliantly.
Well, I think he just have been thinking about this in a rational way. What do we need to do to make America great again, right? I mean, it's like this is the contradiction as well within Bernie's politics, that he's for open borders, but he says he's concerned for American jobs, for example. It's a complete contradiction in terms. And you would even think then that some people on the left would be more attracted to what Trump brings to the table, the workers, etc. And I think he is also winning that audience. He's winning over a lot of Democrats over to the Republican Party. And what's interesting now to watch is, of course, that many conservatives are going nuts over this. They can't believe that this is happening. He's changing what conservatism means, or he's trying to. They think he's trying to hijack the party. He's a dangerous leftist or something, you know, that's trying to take it over. But where will the Republican elite go now? What are they going to do? Will they get behind him? What's going to happen here next, do you think?
That is an excellent question. I wish I had a convincing prediction on that. I think that, as inevitably happens, when power coalesces around an individual, people will be attracted to that individual. They will swallow whatever reservations they had, but they are so attracted to power and being part of an administration that if it looks as though Trump has a chance in the general election, their people are going to bury the hatchet and they will swarm to him. Right now you have all of these prominent Republicans saying, oh, no, I'll even vote for Hillary. Well,
right.
Maybe they will. We'll see. But if that man is elected president, people will forget all about that. He'll have no trouble attracting people to work in a Trump administration. Now, the real question is, what then happens to the Republican Party if Trump loses the general election? That is a fascinating prospect. And many people at our end of the political spectrum are saying, okay, we must seize this moment, this excitement, this outpouring of support for taboo views has to be harnessed. It has to be institutionalized. I agree. I'm not quite sure how that's to be done, but it's up to people like you and me to keep that momentum going if Trump is not elected president. But what will happen to the Republicans? To the extent that basically they have joined the left on the really essential question about race, if that party cracks up, I will not shed a single tear.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're talking about creating a third party, bringing in another candidate. But even if that's the case, then Trump has managed to break open the two-party system in America, which is in itself an incredible achievement from a European perspective, at least.
Yeah. Well, see, I really don't think that the Republicans are going to find someone credible to run against Trump as a what? As a new party member to save the Republican Party? They're going to invent a new party to save the Republican Party simply by trying to siphon votes away from Donald Trump so that Donald Trump is defeated? This is so incoherent. I would be astonished if something like that actually takes place.
Yeah, they're panicking. They're trying everything they can to try to remedy what they see as a disaster. But yeah, we'll see what happens here. It's quite interesting, and we'll see if they actually get behind him at the end or not. And if he managed to, you can kind of see that he's trying to bring people together. I think the latest speech he did, I think even spoke well of Kasich, for example, and he's trying to mend the situation. But again, if he's smart, I mean, then that's what he'll try to do, because if he's concerned about what really is happening in America, he will. I'm not saying he should become politically correct or anything like that, but I can understand if he wants to, in some level, tone things down, shall we say, to try to basically get in and actually become president, to change things, you know?
Well, at this point, now that he has defeated all of those old dinosaur Republicans, there's nothing to be gained by continuing to insult them, and he's smart enough to know that. I think he, at any rate, is going to spike the guns. There's going to be a ceasefire, and it'll be up to the rest of the dinosaurs to figure out whether they're going to be dinosaurs or they're going to come into this new age of mammals. But at the same time, what really strikes me as preposterous about these Republicans, these are the same people who have been roaring all over the Middle East, trying to build new nations, teach them democracy, teach them to heed the people's will. These are the very same Republicans who are hoping against hope that he won't get the magic number of delegates, and so they can steal the election from him and thwart the people's will. This is just disgusting hypocrisy to me. They're all for democracy. They're all for the people's will, so long as one of their own gets elected. They go all around the world bragging about how wonderful our people's government is, and this is the way they behave. They should be so ashamed of themselves, and yet, of course, people are never ashamed of themselves. It's really a sad state of affairs.
Well, they think these people are... They're stupid, clearly, right? They're not educated. I mean, I've heard the media go in circles on this many times. in terms of the fact that they've been trying to say that he's a brilliant marketing guy, right? He's somehow managed to fool people into thinking that, you know, to vote for him or support him. They just can't comprehend the fact that it's actually what he's saying, his honest policies that are attractive to people. They just can't comprehend it.
No. It's just too much for them. Oh, their circuit boards just explode. Well, we'll see. This idea that we are the perfect democracy and that we are a light to the world, that we are a model. Democracy is wonderful so long as the people I approve of get elected.
They have to stop the democratic process because otherwise it might lead to fascism, right? So,
yes, right. See, but that's another thing. They used to say this about Jean-Marie Le Pen. They used to say this about Nick Griffin of the BNP. They'd say, these people are against democracy. That somehow, if you vote for people like that, then you are somehow putting some sort of great obstacle in the way to democracy and representative government. I never got that. How does that doesn't even make sense. Nobody is saying, okay, once I'm elected, I'm going to stop the elections. There's no way you could do that.
Right.
Somehow, if you disagree with the standard liberal view on all of the things that matter, then you're against democracy, and voting you in is the last election. I suppose they're just fixated on something that happened, I guess it was 1939, wasn't it? They just can't get that out of their minds.
Yeah, that is right. That is true. Now, we're going to take a break here in a little bit. I want to continue to talk more about Trump in the second segment, and also, of course, the updated color of crime report that you guys have just released. But give us some details again. If there's you had a book out, you said, where can people find that? And give us the website address again so people know where to go to pick up tickets for the upcoming conference.
Well, the conference is going to be May 20th through May 22nd. So it's just 2 weekends away, I guess. And we still have a few spaces available. And people can go to amran.com. That's our webpage, and there is a advertisement right on the homepage. And so we welcome your listeners. I'm sure your listeners are exactly the kinds of people that we would like at our conference, and they're exactly the kind of people who would find the conference an absolutely thrilling and inspiring occasion. So please do come to amran.com.
Very good. What about the book, Jared?
You mean The Color of Crime?
Well, that too, but you mentioned you had a book. I have to admit I'm not that well-versed in some of your books that you've written, but tell us about them and if they're available still.
Oh, yes. I have written, the latest book I've written is called White Identity, and it's an explanation as to why multiracialism, multiculturalism is a complete failure. It goes about it in a very carefully documented manner. And it argues that unless whites express themselves as whites and are prepared to defend their own interests, they face oblivion. I spent about 10 years working on that book. I suppose it would be better if someone else were to sing its praises, but I think that your viewers, your listeners would find it well worth taking a look at. So White Identity, that's too, is advertised on our homepage. And then we'll talk about it later, The Color of Crime. This is our latest, that is too available, both as a free download as a PDF and in paper for those who still like paper. I tend to like paper myself. I'm old-fashioned that way.
Very good. Yeah, that's right. White Identity. I did forget about the book, but I know about it, of course. So that's right. And we'll have a link up to the Amran store to the book as well. But just take a look at the front page and you'll see it right there. Well, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, everyone. Stay with us, Jared. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
We'll continue with Jared Taylor in the second hour now to talk more about Trump and what is going to happen next, both with the election, but also, of course, with the American people, their choice, and also what happens if Trump doesn't get in. We'll also get the scoop on the updated Color of Crime report. So please join us at redicemembers.com. Watch or listen to the second half of this program. We will be back in just a few days. We are still trying to catch up a bit after the delay that the live show resulted in. That is what many days of preparation and setting up everything to get the tech working does to you. So thank you for your patience on that. All right, but we'll see you after the break. Thanks for listening. Stick around. We'll be right back.